Welcome to Voices of Resilience, a special series from the Vital Voices podcast, where we're sharing stories of courage, commitment, innovation, and perseverance from women leaders in unprecedented crisis. I'm your host, Elise Nelson. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Claire Russo. Claire is a former member of the U.S. Marine Corps and recently ran for Congress in her district in Virginia. And while running for Congress, Claire made the courageous decision to share her story of sexual assault in the Marines in one of her campaign ads, calling attention not only to sexual violence in the armed forces, but also the lack of political will and action for prosecuting these crimes. Today, we're speaking with her about her experience, her perspective as a woman who ran for office, and her thoughts about leadership, particularly in this time when we've got a microscope on leaders, and it seems as though everything they're doing is in the spotlight. Please note that this conversation will contain sensitive material that may be triggering to some listeners. So Claire, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Elise. It's really great to be here.
So if it's all right with you, I'd love to just dive right in. Can you tell us about your experience joining the Marines and working your way up the ranks as an officer? What motivated you to join in the first place?
Well, I think at a basic level, you know, what motivated me to join was my love of this country. I mean, I was 10 years old when I decided I wanted to be a Marine. I loved watching people representing our country with pride, and I loved watching the Olympics, and I loved going to sporting events largely because I loved being in a group of people singing the national anthem, and I think that my father immigrated here when he was in his 20s, and he was so grateful to this country for the opportunity that it provided him. He really instilled in us, his kids, that that this country was sort of worth fighting for. And I joined the Marines. I told my parents when I was 10 I was going to be a Marine, and I decided on the Marine Corps because I wanted the toughest and I wanted to be treated the same. I thought that by joining the Marine Corps as a woman, I would be on an equal playing field, and I would be asked to do the same things the men were. I wanted the toughest, and I went to college and I joined the Marine Corps after college. That was 2003, right after 9/11, and just as we were invading Iraq. Entering into the Marine Corps, I was so. It was just so empowering, initially to kind of accomplish the physical accomplishments required to actually become an officer, and the study of leadership and the study of tactics and foreign policy. It was really invigorating for me. So I think my motivation to join it came from childhood, and I was so thrilled to be a part of the Marine Corps and to be a part of what I saw as our foreign policy arm and history.
I can certainly imagine that sort of post 9/11 and all that was going on at the time. As you joined, did you feel welcome as a woman? You believed you'd join and be an equal peer. Is that what you felt initially? Did you face bias or?
I felt that, no, I absolutely faced bias sort of from the beginning. My class in boot camp or officer candidate school, there were probably 300 people, and maybe 60 of which were women in the beginning. I think 12 of us graduated in the end. And you know, there was a lot of discussion by the female leadership, that drill sergeants, about, you know, as a Marine, as a woman in the Marine Corps, you can be one of two things. You can be a hard ass, not the word they used, or you can be a slut. These are your two choices. But there's really no middle ground, and you need to make that choice early. And I remember thinking, like, I joined the Marine Corps to be a leader. I joined the Marine Corps, you know, what is this? And I didn't necessarily, from my male peers, you know, as I went through the Marine Corps, something, a leadership school called the Basic School, which every Marine, no matter what job you're going to have in the Marine Corps, every Marine officer goes through 6 months of basic sort of infantry officer leadership training. And I felt my male peers, there was a little less bias, although still quite a bit. You know, my squad of all men called me mom, because I was the one in the squad who brought all the necessary, sort of provided for them in a lot of ways when we were out in the field. But, you know, as I joined the Fleet Marine Corps and my experiences throughout the Marine Corps, I realized that, you know, the entire system was completely biased against women serving and women climbing the ranks.
Mm. Wow. So you attended the Marine Corps ball in 2004, and the nightmare ensued. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and the actions that were taken afterwards to pursue justice?
Yeah. You know, the Marine Corps takes its birthday very seriously. And every year, the Marine Corps celebrates its birthday on November 10th. And every unit, no matter where they are, whether deployed, you know, in a war zone, they acknowledge and celebrate the birthday in some way. So I was attending something we called the Military Mandatory Fun, which we were all required to attend, the military ball. And meeting, you know, I was still relatively new to the Fleet Marine Corps out of all my schooling, and meeting new officers and that sort of thing. There's alcohol served. Alcohol is a big part of the culture of the Marine Corps ball. And, you know, I met several other Marines that served at the time I was serving at the Miramar Air Station in San Diego, California. And a Marine captain, I was a lieutenant at the time, put something in my drink. You know, he was a friend of my cousin who also served out at Miramar. He basically pursued me and violently sexually assaulted me that night, leaving me sort of drugged and with torn clothing, trying to find my way home in the middle of the night that night. And, you know, I came home just terrified of the reality of having to, you know, I had seen another woman earlier on, just the year before, assaulted, report it, and be essentially run out of the unit that we were in, and really kind of intimidated out of pursuing charges against the individual who assaulted her. And so the immediate aftermath, I thought, I just don't want to tell, you know, I can't go through that. I feel so mortified. I feel so ashamed. And there's no way I don't want to tell anyone about this. You know, I just felt like I want to disappear. But I called my then boyfriend, now husband of 13 years, who was also a Marine, and he was not, he was in a different unit and happened to have been on duty that night. So kind of working all night at his unit. And I called him, and I was very upset, and he knew something was wrong. He came down. It was about an hour away in San Diego, and he showed up at my house, and I said, I just want to leave. I don't want to see, and I just want to be out of my house. I don't want to be here. And I think he could tell what was going on. And he said, you know, you've got to talk to somebody, and you've got to talk to someone. And ultimately, my cousin who served in the same unit that I did and knew the man that assaulted me, reached out to me over the phone and said, you know, Claire, what's going on? Where did you disappear to last night? And I told him what had happened, and, you know, he and I ultimately reported it together. And really that's when the real nightmare ensued. I mean, I would never wish a physical, sexually violent assault on anyone, but the trauma that I experienced in reporting this to the Marine Corps was far worse.
Wow. So what happened? Was the legal system even equipped to handle your case? I mean, tell me how the steps that you took to report it. And I think it's wonderful that your cousin joined you in that, because I would imagine it might have been impossible to even do that without his support.
Right. So yeah, the legal system was not equipped, and it's still not equipped. But the real issue was that the leadership wasn't equipped to deal with an assault of this nature, to deal with sexual violence, and to deal with issues relating to women. So we reported by phone. We reported the assault, and I went to, I went to a hospital to be examined. Very quickly, I got a phone call from a federal investigating service, from the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, while I was sitting in the waiting room to be examined in a hospital. And they said, do not let the Naval Hospital touch you. You need to come back onto base right now, and we're going to drive you to a special forensic nurse who can do the examination on you. So literally sort of pulled out of a doctor's office, pulled out of the waiting area to see the doctor, the waiting room to see the doctor. My cousin and I leave the Naval Hospital. At this point, it's like 11 o'clock the next night. We drive an hour to a special forensic nurse with an NCIS agent who, you know, gives me an exam, a sexual assault, a SART exam. The police show up and I think, oh, that's interesting. The police are here. I do have the NCIS agent with me, so I have some representation from the military or the federal government. The exam was horrifying. You know, there was significant physical wounds to my body. And I gave several statements that night over and over and over again about what had happened to the NCIS agent. And then I went home. And you know, I slept for a day or two, and I was given some time. You know, it was the leadership didn't know what to do or how to handle it. So they basically, it was up to me to decide how long I stayed away from work, when I saw it, if I saw a doctor, when I saw a doctor. But no one contacted me, not a lawyer, not a victim advocate. You know, I was really alone in sort of understanding how to pursue, you know, the right medical care, psychiatric, psychological care. And so, you know, essentially I decided I'm not going to let this stop me. I'm not going to let this define me. I'm going to go back to work. I am going to be the Marine that I joined to be, and I'm not going to let this, you know, throw me off course. And I returned to work about, I think it was about 10 days after the assault. And I was in charge of a shop, intelligence shop of about 12 Marines. They all happened to be men. And when I walked in the first day after the assault, none of the Marines would look, they all sort of looked at the floor. And I mean, I immediately knew something was wrong. And another lieutenant from another shop appeared within 30 minutes of me arriving and said, hey, I need to talk to you. And told me that my commander had told the entire intelligence shop at the air wing about the assault.
Whoa.
So that drove me home immediately. I mean, I couldn't keep it together. The Marines couldn't look at me.
And why did they do that?
They... did that. He did that. I mean, he and I sort of talked about this eventually, but he didn't, he thought he was doing the right thing. He had no guidance. He had been in, he had joined the Marine Corps in, you know, post-Vietnam era. He had been in the enlisted in the Navy and then transferred into the Marine Corps. He was a lieutenant colonel, but he had been in for something like 38 years. And really, he had no idea what he was doing. In many ways, I often defend him because I don't think he was deliberately trying to sort of intimidate me, but it was a lack of preparedness and a system that just had absolutely, the leadership had no idea how to handle the assault. So they started off by completely violating my privacy and making it nearly impossible for me to serve in that unit.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And was there ever any justice?
You know, I spent the better part of the next 6 months fighting to get the Marine Corps to press charges. And, you know, I was begging, please transfer me off this base. I ran into the man who assaulted me in a parking lot and I had a panic attack in the parking lot. You know, I urinated, I collapsed and I urinated on myself. I was sobbing in the parking lot. I was, you know, it was so unbelievably traumatic and I felt so vulnerable. And with every day that passed when charges weren't being pressed, I felt as though no one believed me. And that can really make you feel crazy. Ultimately, the senior legal officer at the Air Wing told me that it was not a crime to anally assault someone according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and therefore they would not be able to prosecute the man who assaulted me. And that was just not acceptable to me. You know, I worked then with the Naval Criminal Investigative Service and the district attorney, because the Marine Corps ball was hosted off of federal land in San Diego. The San Diego district attorney could prosecute. And so I started working with the San Diego district attorney. And as soon as I did, I had my security clearance taken away. I had, you know, folks, leadership from the Air Wing calling and really trying to intimidate me, honestly, out of continuing to pursue charges. And, you know, it turned out that this man had assaulted another female Marine 6 months earlier, also pushed under the rug. And so I did, in fact, you know, I ultimately, the San Diego district attorney pressed charges. The man who assaulted me pled guilty before the trial even started and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He was in prison for 3 months before the Marine Corps even held a discharge hearing. I mean, so the justice is that, you know, the system that I pledged to defend as a Marine and that I was willing to lay my life down for did in fact provide me justice. But the heartbreak came from the fact that, you know, I had always wanted to be a Marine, and what I felt was that the Marines didn't really want me.
Wow. Your courage in sharing your story is just really incredible. And I know that you've not only shared it, obviously, to seek justice and to help others. I mean, I have no doubt if you hadn't, he would have kept on his horrific behavior. So obviously, you've helped many others by coming forward. But I know that you also, as I said in the introduction, that you've shared this as part of your campaign when running for Congress. And I remember seeing the advertisement and thinking, wow. Wow, that takes guts. One, because, you know, just the courage to say it publicly. And then two, what would people think? Would it hurt you? Would it help you? What it had never been done before. And I, you know, as I mentioned to you before, I mean, I was just, we need to talk to her. It really hit me just so strongly that you had the courage to do that. So I would imagine that you and those involved in your campaign probably had a lot of discussions and deliberation about, you know, should you share this, should you not? Or had you always thought, I'm going to do that? Can you walk us through sort of how you decided to share your story more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, so first off, I had shared my story quite a bit, you know, before I ran for Congress. And so I had, in the sense that I still, anytime the military asks, I speak in the, for the Ready and Resilient campaign, which is really a sort of a catch-all campaign, a ending suicide, building more resilient communities, facing sexual assault sort of month they do every year where they do trainings. And I've spoken to groups of, you know, 5,000 armed services, members of the armed services about my assault and about, you know, what I see as the way that we build a resilient community that can not only sustain the reporting of this and the prosecution of individuals who do this, but also, you know, sort of reintegrate victims so that victims aren't shunned and don't feel sort of isolated. But, you know, it's funny that deciding to run for Congress was so much about, you know, the nature of politics, the politics of this, the current president being so personal, feeling like it was so personal. The way that, you know, the president talks about women, the way that the president has dealt with women, Violence Against Women Act being voted down, you know, that those things felt so personal to me. I'm the mother of two girls. And so I was driven to run because it felt as though I had to act. And as I say, it felt so personal that it was just like, I've got to step up and I have to do this now. But, you know, when I was talking, when we were talking with my whole team as a candidate, I think initially the assault was something that they found dangerous, politically interesting, but they weren't, you know, they didn't know me yet. So initially, you know, I worked in Afghanistan building teams of women to increase women's participation in our counterinsurgency strategy, in our sort of development and reconstruction in Afghanistan. And I trained the first team of women to go be a part of the Army Special Forces and worked to integrate women into our defense system writ large, strategically. And so, you know, I worked in the intelligence community. And so what qualified me to be in Congress was my resume and what I had, you know, the work I had done. But I think the more that we got to know each other and the more that I got to know voters in my district and voters just writ large, like, our political system is so much emotional and it's so much about the individual. And this particular time in our political history, I think, is also very personal and very emotional. And so, you know, the assault and overcoming it and fighting for justice and sort of survivor turned advocate part of my story, you know, it's really kind of foundational to who I am, but I think it's also what taught me how to sort of how to fight for what's right. And I think that that was a message we really wanted to convey to the folks here. And it was a risk. And I definitely, you know, sharing my story, there were a lot of people who responded to me, even friends who said, you know, being assaulted doesn't qualify you to be in Congress. Yeah. And, you know, I never said it did. But it's a really, it has been such a formative experience for me. And it is so much, you know, I'm always going to be me. I worked really hard to be the person that I am today. And I work really hard on the person that I am. And the assault was so formative. My experience with the incredible women who helped fight, the district attorney who fought and won, and the women around me who helped me be strong enough to fight. It just felt like this is a story that we have to share. Like, we as a nation have to face the reality of sexual violence in this country, of the bias against women in leadership. And, you know, in our district here in Virginia 5, the man that won the Republican nomination, his entire platform is essentially based on the fact that women have no rights. The sanctity of life of a mother is unimportant. And that, to me, is insane that in 2020, you can run on the fact that, like, you know, a woman being threatened by a man doesn't have the same rights to stand her ground as a man. A woman's life isn't as important as a baby's. It's just really, really, it's a really important time for this nation to face this reality. And I have two girls. So sharing the story was a journey to get to the point where we all decided it was the right thing to do. But it was so empowering for so many. And it was so, it was the right decision, you know?
It was absolutely the right decision. And, you know, I think, and just as I said before, I mean, such a bold decision. You know, I think for us, you know, working with so many leaders at Vital Voices all over the world, one of the things that I think differentiates a lot of women as leaders is that we have an experience, good, bad, maybe a series of experiences, and it hits us really hard, and we make a choice, right? We make a choice to step up to, you know, right the wrong. We make a choice to turn the pain that we felt into fuel and power to make sure others don't feel that same pain. And I think that when leadership comes from that place and is motivated by a personal experience that just grabs you, that's what true leadership is about. Because I think it is hard to know the agenda of, you know, the man you talk about, you know, running against you. But I think for you, it's very easy for us to understand what motivated you is to right a wrong, right? And to right other wrongs. And I think that motivation to seek power, to empower, is, you know, I mean, that is the kind of leadership we need desperately in our world right now. And we are seeing it in display in little flickers of light, but we are also seeing something that is pushing very hard against that. Yeah. And I wonder, in your political candidacy, what did you really learn about leadership? What were like the core lessons that you learned about what makes someone a great leader, or about your own leadership?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, leadership is about, in many ways, it's about selflessness. Even though when I think of brilliant leaders, I think about their personalities and who they were. It's about being able to take yourself out of the equation in the decision making and make decisions and push people to act in place in the space that is right for them and right for the sort of greater good. And I think that one of the things that I've learned about my leadership is that I lead from a place of truth. I lead from a place of facts and of truth. And I think that sort of intermixes with the decision to share my story, in that so many women and men around me, victims of assault, are afraid to share. They're afraid of the judgment. They're afraid of the experience of people not believing them. And so I think that I learned about what I, one of the big things I learned about my leadership in this experience was I am always going to be me. I'm not manipulating the truth and manipulating the way I see things moving forward or my plan based on special interest, or I hate to use those political terms, but you know, that the way truth and facts are really important parts of being a leader. But one of the other really critical parts of being a leader is something I refer to as sympathetic imagination. And I think that that is something that in my own marriage, I've talked to my husband a lot about, like, you know, men just, I don't find that men have the same sort of sympathetic imagination. I think all day when I'm at home, when I was at home with babies nursing and taking care of them and not at work, I remember thinking about, I wonder what my husband's day is like. I wonder what his experience is like. When I was in Afghanistan, I was thinking about the experience of these, you know, village leaders having 25-year-old young guys all dressed up in uniform coming into their space and telling them what to do and thinking, gosh, from their perspective, this is a really different situation than the way we're presenting it, you know, in the military. And I think that one of the, you know, this ties directly to the power and strength of community, but ultimately that as a leader, you've got to be able to kind of understand things from the perspective of the people you are trying to engage with and the people who are working against you. You know, majority rules in democracy, but ultimately every single voter in my district mattered to me. And I wanted to see things from their perspective and understand where they were coming from and see if there were there were places that we could kind of come to an agreement, knowing that maybe the mechanics of getting there weren't agreeable to both sides. So I think that I learned a lot about just about myself in the sense that that commitment to truth and honesty and helping people come to that same commitment is really important. And it's foundational, you know, to leading.
Yeah. It's incredible that in 2020, a group of powerful women have to come together and write a letter to the editors of major newspapers saying, check yourself. Check your bias in reporting on who we know is going to be a female candidate on a major party ticket for vice president. Now, at that point, we didn't know it was Kamala Harris, also a Black woman, an Asian woman. When you think about the kind of obstacles that you faced and that I'm sure she will face, what advice do you have, not necessarily for her, although certainly for her, but I think for all of us in terms of how we can continuously remind people that, you know, it's 2020,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That women who lead differently, we bring something valuable that is needed. But also give her a chance.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we have to remind people that it's 2020. And, you know, while we cannot lose sight of the road behind us as women fighting for equal rights and the road ahead. And you know, I think that give her a chance is a great line, but I ultimately think that we, as women, it is until equality is achieved, it is how we build resilience in our community of women globally, nationally, politically, state by state, you know, interest group by interest group, such that, you know, you, Kamala Harris, you amazing, you know, civil rights leader in Georgia, you are going to sort of pursue your goals and continue despite the bias you face, despite the unfair reporting, despite the way, you know, you are portrayed in the media, because we have a goal that is worth fighting for. We have something that is worth fighting for, and we are all worth fighting for. Our daughters are worth fighting for. My children, my little girls, seeing Kamala Harris as the vice president, the nominee for vice president on the Democratic ticket is, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes. And so it is about how resilient we can be and how we continue to build resilience within us and, you know, within our networks, such that we can ultimately stamp it out, because progress and moving forward is the only way we keep pursuing this ultimate change.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one more question. What gives you hope right now?
What gives me hope right now? You know, my experience running for Congress, the amazing networks of the amazing voters and citizens in my, you know, not just in my district, all over this country, the strength of the American community to pursue justice, to take care of one another, you know, my own kids, you know, the day that I lost my election, my daughters who are 9 and 7, you know, have been experiencing and seeing the civil rights movement and what's happened in the world in the last, like during my election cycle. And when I told my kids that I lost, my daughter said, "But isn't that good? Cameron Webb, you know, the man that beat me is an African-American doctor." And she said, "Doesn't that mean that we're doing something right in this district? If Cameron Webb wins in this district, you know, like, isn't this a good thing?" And I said, "It absolutely is." And the fact that we are progressing throughout our generations and that we are making progress towards equity and justice, you know, I it's the strength of our communities. It's the strength of that which unites us is so much greater than that which divides us. And that really does give me hope.
Wow. Thank you so much. I so enjoyed our conversation together, Claire, and we're just so grateful to you for your courage and really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real honor.
Thanks for listening to the special edition of the Vital Voices podcast. We hope that you're doing all you can to keep yourselves, your families, your teams, and your communities safe and healthy. If you'd like to support our work with women leaders in this country and around the world, you can donate to Vital Voices on our website at vitalvoices.org. Or you can text VITAL, V-I-T-A-L, to 41444. That's VITAL to 41444. Stay safe and remember that we will get through this unsettling time together.